This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Never Eat Alone and Other Secrets to Success, One Relationship at a Time by Keith Ferrazzi with Tal Raz. Narrated by Richard Harries and directed by Ian McCulloch.
Preface. 1 hour from Salt Lake City, in a Utah town called Eden, is a breathtaking vista of snow, trees, and sky called Powder Mountain. In 2013, a group of remarkable 20-somethings raised $40 million to purchase the 10,000-acre site. On it, they're going to build an eco-retreat and second home, or third, or fourth, or fifth, for successful entrepreneurs who want to make the world better. It's an audacious vision. The story of how these young upstarts make it happen is the finest example I know of the principles, mindsets, and practices of this book come to life. In 2008, Elliot Bisnow, then 22, had been hustling successfully as an ad salesman for his father's small email newsletter business. So successfully that the company had grown beyond their ability to manage and grow it. Bisnow knew he had a knowledge problem, but he didn't think business school. After all, he was in the weeds and needed answers yesterday. Reading Never Eat Alone, at the time, pushed him to reframe the problem. What he really needed was access to a network that could provide him with the mentorship and advice he needed to help a rapidly growing business. This wasn't a knowledge problem. It was a people problem, with a people solution. Just as the book prescribed, he created a relationship action plan, listing all his prospects, top entrepreneurs who could share with him the lessons of their success. Then he hit the phone for cold calling with an offer so generous they couldn't refuse, an all-expenses-paid ski weekend. Bisnow charged $15,000 to his own credit card to make it happen, where they could rub shoulders with fellow successful entrepreneurs and mentor young up-and-comers, chiefly Bisnow, who were bent not just on financial success, but on making a positive social impact. A free weekend ski trip and an opportunity to change the world? I sure would have said yes. In fact, I probably would have paid to attend. As it turned out, I wasn't the only one. And boom, Bisnow had a new venture. Over the course of a few years, the retreats grew into a thriving event business called Summit Series, with both for-profit and non-profit wings. Summit isn't just in the business of helping launch entrepreneurs. It's in the business of creating community, the most valuable form of social capital. The intimate, supportive relationships that spur collaboration while deeply satisfying our human need for connection, belonging, and meaning. Otherwise put, a lifelong community of colleagues, contacts, friends, and mentors. What the past decade of social science research tells us is that satisfying these relational needs isn't just about some soft notion of the good life. These are the hard prerequisites for creativity, innovation, progress, and at the end of that chain, profit. Now Summit Series is making a permanent home in Powder Mountain, where longtime Summit notables like billionaire investor Peter Thiel are among those who dropped up to $2 million apiece for their own plots of land. The move underlines the likely longevity not just of Summit, but of the ideas that have driven its success. Bisnow's story is an inspiring walk through the lessons of this book. Generosity in relationships above all. Audacity. Social arbitrage. Blending the personal and professional. Connecting through passions. Giving back. Having fun. Although I'd really like to, I can't take credit for Summit Series. I'm only a lucky participant in what Bisnow and his group have created. but I can honestly crow that Bisnow acknowledges Never Eat Alone as the operating manual that helped him to shape and execute his vision. And he's one of thousands whom I've heard from, who have built not just a career, but entire organizations on the philosophy and precepts found in the book. Here's Summit's own informal code of conduct. 1. Go on a learning safari. Everyone has something to teach. Everyone has something to learn. Take an intellectual, spiritual, and creative journey. 2. Build friendships. Summit Series isn't about networking. It's about building lifelong friends. The people around you are amazing. Get to know them. 3. Embrace synchronicity. The unexpected moments are often the most meaningful. Embrace them. 4. Show love. Summit Series is about character, not resumes. Show love to the startups, and don't fanboy the big-timers. 5. Have fun. If it's not fun, it doesn't count. Welcome to the social era. What the success of Bisnow and his community, and that of many other thousands who have written to me with their success stories, tells me is that Never Eat Alone was much more than my story. What seemed to me to be my unique and zealous drive to connect and succeed as a poor kid in a Pittsburgh steel town was in fact shaped by forces much larger than what was afoot on our local golf course, where I learned so much as a caddy. The world was changing, and changing me with it. Or maybe I had the right genetic code to thrive in this new ecosystem. Either way, this book turned out to be the field guide for an entirely new era of business. In the decades since, I've built a company to help our clients thrive amid the throttle of change by building and leveraging better relationships. Together, we've invested heavily in studying and understanding subjects long left to other disciplines, such as emotion, intuition, behavior, trust, influence, power, reciprocity, networks, and all those things that touch on how we relate to and work with other people. Two amazing things have happened concurrently. 1. Networking, once a dirty word, has become the lingua franca of our times, acknowledged as an inherently human pursuit, not ugly or exploitative, but inherent to the forces of reciprocity that drive human development and a collaborative economy. Today's most valuable currency is social capital, defined as the information, expertise, trust, and total value that exist in the relationships you have and social networks to which you belong. 2. Science has validated the equation that 10 years ago was just my nagging intuition. Success in life equals the people you meet plus what you create together. Your network is your destiny, a reality backed up by many studies in the newly emergent fields of social networking and social contagion theory. We are the people we interact with. Our paychecks, our moods, the health of our hearts, and the size of our bellies, all of these things are determined by whom we choose to interact with and how. And so, taking control of your relationships, which if you're doing it right sometimes means giving up control, as I've learned over the years and especially since having become a father, means taking control of your career and your future. The lessons in this book have never been more potent, or more important. And it's set to get only more so. Today's kids pull out the umbilical cord and plug in the internet, their very earliest consciousness shaped by constant awareness and interaction with the global hive. Their social media-driven upbringing will make them savants in some areas of relationship building and idiots in others. And I suspect they'll be spending the next decades sorting out which is which. Just in time for the next revolution. Fortunately for young readers and old, this book now covers the gambit. When NEA was first published, a few references to cybernauts by Palm Pilot and the revolutionary contact management tool Plaxo were all it took to put the book at the cutting edge of technology and digital relationship management. Today, social media and mobile devices have inarguably transformed how we manage relationships, create influence, and develop social capital. As the years passed, fans have been increasingly persistent in telling me the book needed an update if it wanted to continue to deliver on its reputation as the best all-purpose tactical companion to building relationships. In updating Never Eat Alone, I look to preserve much of the original content, because frankly, it still works. I've added 3 new chapters and updated throughout to clarify and strengthen the book for the digital era. Although the technology may have developed, the book's original foundational mindsets, generosity, authenticity, and a belief that greatness is anyone's to seize, regardless of economic background, ethnicity, age, or gender, so long as they provide ever-increasing value to others, are thankfully here to stay. Today, these same cultural virtues drive the engine of social media. How to read this book. You'll get the most from this book if your desire to learn is exceeded only by your willingness to act. Apply the principles and tactics as you read them. My operative mindset is that whatever your age or situation, your path to greatness begins the moment you find the courage and the audacity to reach out with generosity. Relationship development and social savoir-faire require active learning. If you wait until you're a master to dive in, you'll waste months or years, if you ever get started. Here are just a few things that this book will allow you to do. 1. Create a fulfilling, authentic, effective networking strategy that lasts a lifetime. 2. Build and align social capital to achieve ever more ambitious goals. 3. Combine strategy and serendipity to keep in constant contact with a wide network of people. 4. Filter and prioritize your relationships for quality interchange that supports your goals and values. 5. Cultivate a magnetic personal brand that has people clamoring to share information, access, and resources. 6. Translate that brand to social media to build a devoted online tribe. 7. Increase your value to your network, and specifically to your company or clients. 8. Create innovative content to build a reputation as an expert and increase your online influence. 9. Get discovered and tapped for the best opportunities. 10. Create a life that you love and the network to cheer you on. More than 500,000 readers, from high school students to celebrated CEOs, in more than 16 different countries worldwide, have achieved great things by mastering the art of working with others through Never Eat Alone. Join them. Section 1. The Mindset. Chapter 1. Becoming a Member of the Club. Margaret Wheatley wrote, "Relationships are all there is. Everything in the universe only exists because it is in relationship to everything else. Nothing exists in isolation. We have to stop pretending we are individuals that can go it alone." How on earth did I get in here? I kept asking myself in those early days as an overwhelmed first-year student at Harvard Business School. There wasn't a single accounting or finance class in my background. Looking around me, I saw ruthlessly focused young men and women who had undergraduate degrees in business. They'd gone on to crunch numbers or analyze spreadsheets in the finest firms on Wall Street. Most were from wealthy families and had pedigrees and legacies and Roman numerals in their names. Sure, I was intimidated. How was a guy like me from a working-class family with a liberal arts degree and a couple years at a traditional manufacturing company going to compete with purebreds from McKinsey and Goldman Sachs, who, from my perspective, seemed as if they'd been computing business data in their cribs? It was a defining moment in my career and in my life. I was a country boy from southwestern Pennsylvania, raised in a small, hard-working steel and coal town outside of Latrobe, called Youngstown. Our region was so rural, you couldn't see another house from the porch of our modest home. My father worked in the local steel mill. On weekends, he'd do construction. My mother cleaned the homes of the doctors and lawyers in a nearby town. My brother escaped small-town life by way of the army. My sister got married in high school and moved out when I was a toddler. At Harvard Business School, all the insecurities of my youth came rushing back. You see, although we didn't have much money, my dad and mom were set on giving me the kind of opportunities my brother and sister, from my mom's previous marriage, never got. My parents pushed me and sacrificed everything to get me the kind of education that only the well-to-do kids in our town could afford. The memories rushed back to those days when my mother would pick me up in our beat-up blue Nova at the bus stop of the private elementary school I attended, while the other children ducked into limos and BMWs. I was teased mercilessly about our car and my polyester clothes and fake Docksiders, reminded daily of my station in life. The experience was a godsend in many ways, toughening my resolve and fueling my drive to succeed. It made clear to me there was a hard line between the haves and the have-nots. It made me angry to be poor. I felt excluded from what I saw as the old boys' network. On the other hand, all those feelings pushed me to work harder than everyone around me. Hard work, I reassured myself, was one of the ways I'd beaten the odds and gotten into Harvard Business School. But there was something else that separated me from the rest of my class and gave me an advantage. I seemed to have learned something long before I arrived in Cambridge that it seemed many of my peers had not. As a kid, I caddied at the local country club for the homeowners and their children living in the wealthy town next to mine. It made me think often and hard about those who succeed and those who don't. I made an observation in those days that would alter the way I viewed the world. During those long stretches on the links, as I carried their bags, I watched how the people who had reached professional heights unknown to my father and mother helped each other. They found one another jobs, they invested time and money in one another's ideas, and they made sure their kids got help getting into the best schools, got the right internships, and ultimately got the best jobs. Before my eyes, I saw proof that success breeds success, and indeed, the rich do get richer. Their web of friends and associates was the most potent club the people I caddied for had in their bags. poverty, I realized, wasn't only a lack of financial resources. It was isolation from the kind of people that could help you make more of yourself. I came to believe that in some very specific ways, life, like golf, is a game, and that the people who know the rules and know them well play it best and succeed. And the rule in life that has unprecedented power is that the individual who knows the right people for the right reasons and utilizes the power of these relationships can become a member of the club, whether he started out as a caddy or not. This realization came with some empowering implications. To achieve your goals in life, I realized, it matters less how smart you are, how much innate talent you're born with, or even, most eye-opening to me, where you came from and how much you started out with. Sure, all these are important, but they mean little if you don't understand one thing. You can't get there alone. In fact, you can't get very far at all. Fortunately, I was hungry to make something of myself, and frankly, even more terrified that I'd amount to nothing. Otherwise, perhaps I would have just stood by and watched like my friends in the caddy yard. I first began to learn about the incredible power of relationships from Mrs. Poland. Carol Poland was married to the owner of the big lumber yard in our town, and her son Brett, who was my age, was my friend. They went to our church. At the time, I probably wanted to be Brett. Great athlete, rich, all the girls falling over him. At the club, I was Mrs. Poland's caddy. I was the only one who cared enough, ironically, to hide her cigarettes. I busted my behind to help her win every tournament. I'd walk the course the morning before to see where the tough pin placements were. I'd test the speed of the greens. Mrs. Poland started racking up wins left and right. Every ladies' day I did such a great job that she would brag about me to her friends. Soon, others requested me. I'd caddy 36 holes a day if I could get the work, and I made sure I treated the club caddy master as if he were a king. My first year, I won the annual caddy award, which gave me the chance to caddy for Arnold Palmer when he came to play on his hometown course. Arnie started out as a caddy himself at the La Trobe Country Club and went on to own the club as an adult. I looked up to him as a role model. He was living proof that success in golf and in life had nothing to do with class. It was about access. Yes, and talent, at least in his case. Some gained access through birth or money. Some were fantastic at what they did, like Arnold Palmer. My edge, I knew, was my initiative and drive. Arnie was inspirational proof that your past need not be prologue to your future. For years, I was a de facto member of the Poland family, splitting holidays with them and hanging out at their house nearly every day. Brett and I were inseparable, and I loved his family like my own. Mrs. Poland made sure I got to know everyone in the club who could help me, and if she saw me slacking, I'd hear about it from her. I helped her on the golf course, and she, in appreciation of my efforts and the care I bestowed upon her, helped me in life. She provided me with a simple but profound lesson about the power of generosity. When you help others, they often help you. Reciprocity is the gussied-up word people use later in life to describe this ageless principle. I just knew the word as care. We cared for each other, so we went out of our way to do nice things. Because of those days, and specifically that lesson, I came to realize that first semester at business school that Harvard's hyper-competitive, individualistic students had it all wrong. Success in any field, but especially in business, is about working with people, not against them. No tabulation of dollars and cents can account for one immutable fact. Business is a human enterprise driven and determined by people. It wasn't too far into my second semester before I started jokingly reassuring myself, how on earth did these other people get in here? What many of my fellow students lacked, I discovered, were the skills and strategies that are associated with fostering and building relationships. In America, and especially in business, we're brought up to cherish John Wayne individualism. People who consciously court others to become involved in their lives are seen as schmoozers, brown-nosers, smarmy sycophants. Over the years, I learned that the outrageous number of misperceptions clouding those who are active relationship builders is equaled only by the misperceptions of how relationship building is done properly. What I saw on the golf course, friends helping friends, and families helping families they cared about, had nothing to do with manipulation or quid pro quo. Rarely was there any running tally of who did what for whom or strategies concocted in which you gave just so you could get. Over time, I came to see that reaching out to people as a way to make a difference in people's lives, as well as a way to explore and learn and enrich my own, it became the conscious construction of my life's path. Once I saw my networking efforts in this light, I gave myself permission to practice it with abandon in every part of my professional and personal life. I didn't think of it as cold and impersonal, the way I thought of networking. I was instead connecting, sharing my knowledge and resources, time and energy, friends and associates, and empathy and compassion, in a continual effort to provide value to others, while coincidentally increasing my own. Like business itself, being a connector is not about managing transactions, but about managing relationships. People who instinctively establish a strong network of relationships have always created great businesses. If you strip business down to its basics, it's still about people selling things to other people. That idea can get lost in the tremendous hubbub the business world perpetually stirs up around everything from brands and technology to design and price considerations in an endless search for the ultimate competitive advantage. But ask any accomplished CEO or entrepreneur or professional how they achieve their success, and I guarantee you'll hear very little business jargon. What you will mostly hear about are the people who help pave their way, if they are being honest and not too caught up in their own success. After decades of successfully applying the power of relationships in my own life and career, I've come to believe that connecting is one of the most important business and life skill sets you'll ever learn. Why? Because flat out, people do business with people they know and like. Careers, in every imaginable field, work the same way. Even our overall well-being and sense of happiness, as the library's worth of research has shown, is dictated in large part by the support and guidance and love we get from the community we build for ourselves. It took me a while to figure out exactly how to go about connecting with others, but I knew for certain that whether I wanted to become President of the United States or President of a local PTA, there were a lot of other people whose help I would need along the way. Self-help, a misnomer. How do you turn an acquaintance into a friend? How can you get other people to become emotionally invested in your advancement? Why are there some lucky schmoes who always leave business conferences with months' worth of lunch dates and a dozen potential new associates, while others leave with only indigestion. Where are the places you go to meet the kind of people who could most impact your life? From my earliest days growing up in La Trobe, I found myself absorbing wisdom and advice from every source imaginable. Friends, books, neighbors, teachers, family. My thirst to reach out was almost unquenchable. But in business, I found nothing came close to the impact of mentors. At every stage in my career, I sought out the most successful people around me and asked for their help and guidance. I first learned the value of mentors from a local lawyer named George Love. He and the town's stockbroker, Walt Sailing, took me under their wings. I was riveted by their stories of professional life and their nuggets of street-smart wisdom. My ambitions were sown in the fertile soil of George and Walt's rambling business escapades, and ever since, I've been on the lookout for others who could teach or inspire me. Later in life, as I rubbed shoulders with business leaders, store owners, politicians, and movers and shakers of all stripes, I started to gain a sense of how our country's most successful people reach out to others and how they invite those people's help in accomplishing their goals. I learned that real networking was about finding ways to make other people more successful. It was about working hard to give more than you get. And I came to believe that there was a litany of tough-minded principles that made this soft-hearted philosophy possible. These principles would ultimately help me achieve things I didn't think I was capable of. They would lead me to opportunities otherwise hidden to a person of my upbringing, and they'd come to my aid when I failed, as we all do on occasion. I was never in more dire need of that aid than during my first job out of business school at Deloitte & Touche Consulting. By conventional standards, I was an awful entry-level consultant. Put me in front of a spreadsheet and my eyes glaze over, which is what happened when I found myself on my first project, huddled in a cramped, windowless room in the middle of suburbia, files stretching from floor to ceiling, poring over a sea of data, with a few other first-year consultants. I tried. I really did. But I just couldn't. I was convinced boredom that bad was lethal. I was clearly well on my way to getting fired or quitting. Luckily, I had already applied some of the very rules of networking that I was still in the process of learning. In my spare time, when I wasn't painfully attempting to analyze some data-ridden worksheet, I reached out to ex-classmates, professors, old bosses, and anyone who might stand to benefit from a relationship with Deloitte. I spent my weekends giving speeches at small conferences around the country on a variety of subjects I had learned at Harvard, mostly under the tutelage of Len Schlesinger, to whom I owe my speaking style today. All this in an attempt to drum up both business and buzz for my new company. I had mentors throughout the organization, including the CEO, Pat Lakanto. Still, my first annual review was devastating. I received low marks for not doing what I was asked to do with the gusto and focus that was expected of me. But my supervisors, with whom I had already developed relationships and who were aware of my extracurricular activities, had another idea. Together we cooked up a job description that previously did not exist at the company. My mentors gave me a $150,000 expense account to do what I had already been doing, developing business, representing the firm with speaking engagements, and reaching out to the press and business world in ways that would strengthen Deloitte's presence in the marketplace. My supervisor's belief in me paid off. Within a year, the company's brand recognition in the line of business on which I focused, re-engineering, moved from bottom of the consulting pack to one of the top of the industry, achieving a growth rate the company had never known, though, of course, it wasn't all my doing. I went on to become the company's chief marketing officer and the youngest person ever tapped for partner, and I was having a blast. The work was fun, exciting, interesting. Everything you could want in a job. While my career was in full throttle, in some ways, it all seemed like a lucky accident. In fact, for many years, I couldn't see exactly where my professional trajectory would take me. After Deloitte, a crazy quilt of top-level jobs culminating in my founding my own company. It's only today, looking in the rearview mirror, that it makes enormous sense. From Deloitte, I became the youngest chief marketing officer in the Fortune 500 at Starwood Hotel and Resorts. Then I went on to become CEO of a Knowledge Universe Michael Milken-funded video game company, and now founder of my own company, Farazi Greenlight, a research institute, consultancy, and coaching firm focused on changing behavior in the workplaces of the world's most prestigious organizations. I zigged and zagged my way to the top. Every time I contemplated a move or needed advice, I turned to the circle of friends I had created around me. At first, I tried to draw attention away from my people skills for fear that they were somehow inferior to other more respectable business abilities. But as I got older, everyone from well-known CEOs and politicians to college kids and my own employees came to me asking for advice on how to do those things I had always loved doing. Crain's magazine listed me as one of the 40 top business leaders under 40, and the World Economic Forum labeled me as a global leader for tomorrow. Senator Hillary Clinton asked me to use my connecting skills to raise money for her favorite nonprofit organization, Save America's Treasures. Friends and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies asked if I could help them throw more intimate dinner parties for their lead prospects and clients in key parts of the country. MBA students sent me emails, hungry to learn the people skills their business schools weren't teaching them. Those turned into formal training courses, now taught at the most prestigious MBA programs in America. The underlying softer skills I used to arrive at my success, I learned, were something others could benefit from learning. Of course, building a web of relationships isn't the only thing you need to be successful. But building a career and a life with the help and support of friends and family and associates has some incredible virtues. 1. It's never boring. Time-consuming, sometimes. Demanding, perhaps. But dull, never. You're always learning about yourself, other people, business, and the world, and it feels great. 2. A relationship-driven career is good for the companies you work for because everyone benefits from your own growth. It's the value you bring that makes people want to connect with you. You feel satisfaction when both your peers and your organization share in your advancement. 3. Connecting, with the support, flexibility, and opportunities for self-development that come along with it, happens to make a great deal of sense in our new work world. The loyalty and security once offered by organizations can be provided by our own networks. Lifetime corporate employment is dead. We're all free agents now, managing our own careers across multiple jobs and companies. And because today's primary currency is information, a wide-ranging network is one of the surest ways to become and remain thought leaders of our respective fields. Today I have over 10,000 people in my phone's contacts who will answer when I call. They are there to offer expertise, jobs, help, encouragement, support, and yes, even care and love. The very successful people I know are, as a group, not especially talented, educated, or charming. But they all have a circle of trustworthy, talented, and inspirational people whom they can call upon. All of this takes work. It involves a lot of sweat equity, just as it did for me back in the caddy yard. It means you have to think hard, not only about yourself, but about other people. Once you're committed to reaching out to others and asking for their help at being the best at whatever you do, you'll realize, as I have, what a powerful way of accomplishing your goals this can be. Just as important, it will lead to a much fuller, richer life, surrounded by an ever-growing, vibrant network of people you care for and who care for you. This book outlines the secrets behind the success of so many accomplished people. They are secrets that are rarely recognized by business schools, career counselors, or therapists. By incorporating the ideas I discuss in this book, you too can become the center of a circle of relationships, one that will help you succeed throughout life. Of course, I'm a bit of a fanatic in my efforts to connect with others. I do the things I'm going to teach you with a certain degree of, well, exuberance. But by simply reaching out to others and recognizing that no one does it alone, I believe you'll see astounding results quickly. Everyone has the capacity to be a connector. After all, if a country kid from Pennsylvania can make it into the club, so can you. See you there. Chapter 2. Don't keep score. George Burton Adams wrote, "There is no such thing as a self-made man. We are made up of thousands of others. Everyone who has ever done a kind deed for us or spoken one word of encouragement to us has entered into the makeup of our character and of our thoughts, as well as our success." When I give talks to college and grad students, they always ask me, "What are the secrets to success? What are the unspoken rules for making it big?" Preferably, they'd like my response wrapped up in a tight package and tied with a neat little bow. Why not? I wanted the same thing at their age. "So you want the inside scoop?" I respond. "Fair enough. I'll sum up the key to success in one word. Generosity." Then I pause, watching the faces of the kids in the crowd as they look back at me with quizzical expressions. Half the group thinks I'm about to tell them a joke. The other half thinks they would have been better off getting a beer rather than attending my talk. I go on to explain that when I was young, my father, a Pennsylvania steel worker, wanted more for me than he ever had. And he expressed this desire to a man whom up until that moment he had never met, the CEO of his company, Alex McKenna. Mr. McKenna liked my dad's moxie and helped me get a scholarship to one of the best private schools in the country, where he was a trustee. Later, Elsie Hillman, chairwoman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, whom I first met after she read in the New York Times about my unsuccessful bid for New Haven City Council in my sophomore year at Yale, lent me money and advice and encouraged me to attend business school. "By the time I was your age," I tell the students, "I had been afforded one of the best educational opportunities in the world, almost purely through the generosity of others. But," I continue, "here's the hard part. you've got to be more than willing to accept generosity. Often, you've got to go out and ask for it. Now I get that look of instant recognition. Almost everyone in the room has had to reach out for help to get a job interview, an internship, or some free advice. And most have been reluctant to ask. Until you become as willing to ask for help as you are to give it, however, you are only working half the equation. That's what I mean by connecting. It's a constant process of giving and receiving, of asking for and offering help. By putting people in contact with one another, by giving your time and expertise and sharing them freely, the pie gets bigger for everyone. This karma-tinged vision of how things work may sound naive to those who have grown cynical of the business world. But while the power of generosity is not yet fully appreciated or applied in the halls of corporate America, its value in the world of networks is proven. I enjoy giving career advice and counseling. It's almost a hobby. I've done this with hundreds of young people, and I get enormous satisfaction hearing from them later on as their careers progress. There are times when I can make a big difference in a young person's life. I can open a door, or place a call, or set up an internship, one of those simple acts by which destinies are altered. But too often, the offer is refused. The recipient will say, "Sorry, but I can't accept the favor because I'm not sure I'll ever be able to repay you." Or, "I'd rather not be obligated to anyone, so I'll have to pass." Sometimes they'll insist right there and then that they return the favor somehow. To me, nothing is as infuriating as encountering such blindness about how things work. Nor is it, as one might assume, a generational issue. I've gotten similar reactions from people of all ages and in all walks of life. A network functions precisely because there's recognition of mutual need. There's an implicit understanding that investing time and energy in building personal relationships with the right people will pay dividends. The majority of 1%ers are in that top stratum because they understand this dynamic, because, in fact, they themselves use the power of their network of contacts and friends to arrive at their present station. But to do so, first you have to stop keeping score. You can't amass a network of connections without introducing such connections to others with equal fervor. The more people you help, the more help you'll have, and the more help you'll have helping others. It's the same phenomenon that you see propelling the success of the top social networking sites. The more people who have access and use it, the more valuable the network becomes. I now have a small army of former mentees, succeeding in any number of industries, helping me to mentor the young people who come to me today. This is not soft-hearted hokum. It's an insight that hard-headed business people would do well to take seriously. Competitive edge in the industrial era was won by constantly re-engineering process and systems. Today it's won by improving relationships. Information, unlike material resources, is fluid. It can appear, be discovered or communicated, or disappear, become outdated, at any moment. Having the best information at the point of need requires excellence in collaboration, co-creation, communication, the engineering of relationships and the networks through which they get work done. We live in an interdependent world. Flattened organizations seek out strategic alliances at every turn. Those who make up a growing pool of free agents are finding they need to work with others to accomplish their goals. More than ever before, zero-sum scenarios where only one party wins often mean, in the long run, that both parties will lose. Win-win has become a necessary reality in a networked world. In a hyper-connected marketplace, cooperation is gaining ground on competition. The game has changed. In 1956, William White's best-selling book, The Organization Man, outlined the archetypal American worker. We donned our gray suit for a large corporation, offering our loyalty in exchange for job security. It was glorified indentured servitude, with few options and few opportunities. Today, however, employers offer little loyalty, and employees give none. Our careers aren't paths so much as landscapes that are navigated. We're free agents, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs, each with our own unique brand. Many people have adapted to these new times with the belief that it's still a dog-eat-dog world, where the meanest, baddest dog in the neighborhood wins. But nothing could be further from the truth. Where employees once found generosity and loyalty in the companies we worked for, today we must find them in a web of our own relationships. It isn't the blind loyalty and generosity we once gave to a corporation. It's a more personal kind of loyalty and generosity, one given to your colleagues, your team, your friends, your customers.
We need one another more than ever, and this isn't sentiment, it's science. In the past 10 years, neuroscientists, psychologists, and economists have made quantum leaps in understanding why some of us flourish in happy, healthy lives, and others do not. What has become clear is that we're not just connected to others. We are the very product of the people and networks to which we are connected. Who you know determines who you are, how you feel, how you act, and what you achieve. As Wired magazine put it in a 2010 cover story, the secret to health and happiness, healthy and happy friends. A half century of medical data has revealed the infectious power of social networks. Sadly, plenty of people bury their heads in the sand and try to function as if it were still 1950. We have a tendency to romanticize independence and see autonomy as a virtue. In my experience, such a view is a career killer. Autonomy is a life vest made out of sand. Independent people who do not have the skills to think and act interdependently may still be good individual producers, but they won't be seen as good leaders or team players. Their careers will begin to stutter and stall before too long.
Let me give you an example. When I was at Deloitte, I was working on a project for the largest HMO in the country, Kaiser Permanente, forcing me to travel between their two headquarters in San Francisco and Los Angeles and back to my home in Chicago on the weekend. It was clear to me early on that I hoped to use the consulting world as a gateway into some other field. Since I was in Los Angeles, I wondered how I might begin to create inroads into the entertainment industry. I wasn't looking to accomplish anything in particular. I just knew that I was interested in the industry, and that when the day came to move on, I wanted to break into Hollywood without having to deliver some agent's mail. Ray Gallo, my best friend from my undergraduate days, was practicing law in Los Angeles. So I called him to get some advice. "Hey, Ray, who do you know in the entertainment world that I can talk to for some advice about breaking into the industry? You know any people who'd be open for a short lunch?" "There's a guy named David who I know through mutual friends, who also went to HBS. Give him a call." David was a smart entrepreneur doing some creative deals in Hollywood. In particular, he had a close connection with the senior executive at one of the studios, whom he had also gone to school with. I was hoping I might get a chance to get to know both of them. David and I met for a cup of coffee at an outdoor cafe in Santa Monica. He was dressed in very dapper, casual L.A. attire. I wore a suit and tie, befitting the button-down Midwestern consultant that I was at the time. After a good deal of back and forth, I asked David a question. "I'm thinking about transitioning into the entertainment industry at some point. Is there anyone you know who you think could lend some helpful advice?"
I was a good friend of a close friend of his. This seemed like a mild request, given the strength of our meeting.
"I do know somebody," he told me. "She is a senior executive at Paramount." "Great. I'd love to meet her," I said excitedly. "Is there any chance of arranging a quick introduction? Maybe you could pass on an email."
"I can't," he told me flatly. I was shocked, and my face showed it.
"Keith, here's the situation. It's likely that at some point I'm going to need something from this person or want to ask a personal favor, and I'm just not interested in using the equity that I have with this individual on you, or anyone else for that matter. I need to save that for myself. I'm sorry. I hope you understand."
But I didn't understand. I still don't. His statement flew in the face of everything I knew. He thought of relationships as finite, like a pie that can only be cut into so many pieces. Take a piece away, and there was that much less for him. I knew, however, that relationships are more like muscles. The more you work them, the stronger they become.
If I'm going to take the time to meet with somebody, I'm going to try to make that person successful. But David kept score. He saw every social encounter in terms of diminishing returns. For him, there was only so much goodwill available in a relationship and only so much collateral and equity to burn. What he didn't understand was that it's the exercising of equity that builds equity. That's the big aha that David never seemed to have learned. Jack Pigeon, the headmaster of the Kiske School in southwestern Pennsylvania, where I went to high school, taught me that lesson. He'd built an entire institution on his asking people not, "How can you help me?" but, "How can I help you?" One of the many times Jack came to my aid was when I was a sophomore in college. I'd been enlisted to work during the summer for a woman who was running for Congress against a young Kennedy. Running against a Kennedy in Boston, and for Jack Kennedy's former congressional seat to boot, was for many people a lost cause. But I was young and naive and ready for battle. Unfortunately, we barely had time to don our armor before we were forced to wave the white flag of surrender. A month into the campaign, we ran out of money. 8 other college kids and I were literally thrown out of our hotel room, which doubled as our campaign headquarters, in the middle of the night by a general manager who had not been paid in too long a time. We decided to pack our duffel bags into a rented van, and not knowing what else to do, we headed to Washington, D.C. We innocently hoped we could latch onto another campaign. Boy, we were green. In the middle of the night at some anonymous rest stop on the way to Washington, I called Mr. Pigeon from a payphone. When I told him about our situation, he chuckled. Then he proceeded to do what he has done for several generations of Kiske alums. He opened his Rolodex and started making calls. One of those people he called was Jim Moore, a Kiske alum who was the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce in the Reagan administration. By the time our caravan of lost souls made it to D.C., we all had places to stay, and we were on our way to getting summer jobs. I'm pretty sure that Mr. Pigeon had made a few similar calls for Jim in his day. Mr. Pigeon understood the value of introducing people to people, Kiske boy to Kiske boy. He knew not only the impact it would have on our individual lives, but that the loyalty such acts engender would ultimately reap rewards for the nearly bankrupt, small, 5-building facility in southwestern Pennsylvania he was trying to establish. And so it has. Jim and I are now on the board of directors at our alma mater. And if you were around when Jack first took over the school, Today you'd barely recognize the place, with its ski slopes, golf course, fine arts center, and the sort of sophisticated technology that makes it look like some Midwestern MIT. My point is this. Relationships are